What's going on with this? Okay, is this on? Yep. All right, let's get started. So let's start with just a little clicker question. I'll turn the lights down a little bit. So this is based on the required reading. Let me get rid of some of this. So that's the code for you to join. And so the question here is, can software engineers on a project be stakeholders according to the Software Engineering Book of Knowledge? And this is a question that I think somebody emailed me about and I hadn't responded to, but this is the, so these are your possible answers. Yes, because they're better placed to understand what the software could do than anyone else. Yes, because they may benefit, for example, by developing a component that can be reused. No, because they should elicit the requirements, not impose them. No, for another reason. So let me click run on this. Okay, let's see what people have responded. Has everyone voted? Anyone not voted? Okay, so the winner is yes, because they're better placed to understand what the software could do than anyone else. Well, that might be true that they're better placed to understand what the software could do than anyone else, but that's not a reason for them being a stakeholder. So a stakeholder is somebody who benefits from or has an interest in the system. So they don't have to get a direct benefit, but they have to have some interest in the system. And just having better understanding isn't having an interest. So almost as many people thought B was right, and B is in fact correct. So they are stakeholders because they may develop some code that they can reuse in another project. So when you're working on a software project, once you've worked on a few of them, when you're working on another one, you'll be thinking when you're working on some particular piece of it, maybe I could reuse this later on, because you will have experienced the situation where you're working on something and you think, oh yeah, I worked on something like this before, if only I'd kept a copy of it or whatever. So the software engineers are stakeholders. And just because they're part of the job may entail eliciting requirements doesn't mean they're not stakeholders as well. And of course, that can bring you into conflict. So if you're a stakeholder, and the customers are stakeholders as well, you're not necessarily going to be aligned. So for example, the customer might give you some requirements that mean that you are going to have to develop this component in a way that you're very unlikely to be able to reuse it in the future. And you'd really rather develop it in another way so that you can reuse it. So conflicts amongst requirements can come up with software engineers as well. Okay, so this is an example of the kind of question that you might get asked in, for example, the exam. So is this going to work for me? Hang on. So for the way that was from the required reading. Okay, we haven't been through that particular thing in class, but you're expected to know what's on the required reading. So all the required reading is examinable. And it's very clear on the web page and in the course slides as to what's required and what's just suggested. Suggested reading is not examinable, but it might help you understand the required reading. So that's why it's there. So you should be able to explain these kind of concepts, stakeholders, tacit knowledge, and so on, traceability. You should be able to criticize a requirement, a written requirement. So if you're given an example of a written requirement, you should be able to constructively criticize it. That is not just say this is terrible because of such and such, but it could be improved in these ways. You should, These are just examples of the things that you should be able to do. So you should be able to suggest several ways to elicit requirements from stakeholders, because if you look through the required reading on requirements, that's covered in elicitation is covered. And we've been over it in lectures. And of course, I'm not going to ask you trick questions like, you know, which subsection of the Software Engineering Book of Knowledge is such and such mentioned. You know, you're not expected to know the whole lot verbatim. And there'll be some situations where you might find that their terms are used somewhat differently. And if one of those comes up in the exam, then the question in the exam should disambiguate as to which is used. And an example there is system requirement. If you read the Software Engineering Book of Knowledge, it tells you that system requirements are encompass the whole system that you're dealing with. So let's suppose you're dealing with a real-time controller for a bit of an aeroplane, for example. It's probably got software components. It's probably got hardware components. Some of those may be sort of mechanical things with motors and things like that. So the entire system includes the software, the hardware, all the physical bits. And according to the Software Engineering Book of Knowledge, the system requirements refer to that whole system. And the software requirements are the ones for the software part of the system. Whereas if you read Ian Somerville's book, which is one of the suggested books, so some of you may have looked at that, if you look at system requirement there, he restricts it just to the software. So this is, it's something where there's the term is used differently by different people. Okay, so let's go on to what this lecture is really about. It's the second part of construction, and we're going to be looking at code quality for large-scale systems. So this is directly relevant to your coursework, because a lot of you will be writing code, I think almost all of you will be writing code for your part of the coursework, and you should bear, code quality issues in mind when you do that. So high quality code does what it's supposed to do and won't have to be thrown away when what it needs to do changes. Now, of course, that's not an absolute. If it changes enough, then you do have to throw the code away and start again. But generally speaking, code should have a lifespan through multiple iterations of a piece of software. Code quality is connected with requirement engineering and design, but we're going to just concentrate on the code bit of it itself today. And why do you think code quality is more important in a large project than a small one? Anybody want to? Yeah? Right, exactly. It's because there are more people, and more people are going to end up looking at any given bit of code and needing to understand it, to work on it, debug it, extend it. So in one respect, you yourself count as another person, because a year from now, you will have forgotten why you coded something the way you did. Or maybe not a year, maybe 2 years. If you didn't document it the first time through, then you're going to have, just like anybody else, you're going to have to go and re-understand it. So you need to, if it's well written in the first place, then you'll have everybody who looks at it, including yourself later in time, will be able to understand it more easily. And that can be because of staff movement. Depending on how the team works, code might get reviewed. So even though you wrote it, it might be the case that somebody else is looking at it and reviewing it. When you're debugging, it's after you've written it, you may not remember why you did things the way you did them. And then, of course, for maintenance, when someone else may be working on it that wasn't in the company when you wrote it. And so, as an exercise, what you could do is look at your early Java exercises from Inf1, and you know, critique your code and try and rewrite it in without changing the functionality, try and make it better. And just, you know, think about how if you'd written it more clearly in the first place, you'd understand it more easily. And what's this rewrite it better without changing functionality? What is that? There's a word for that. What's that? Refactor, right. That's what refactoring is. Okay. So there's a number of rules of thumb to writing good code. A lot of it is, some of it is rules to follow, some of it is just experience. So one of the important things is coding standards, so things like where you put the curly brackets, assuming this is Java, where you put the curly brackets, how much you indent things, how you name your variables and your methods. So if you're used to this sort of thing, let's suppose you're used to this kind of thing, so this sort of indenting, and curly brackets like this, you know, and spacing like this. You know, that's one way of doing it. So if that's what you're used to, and then, you know, the guy at the next desk has written something like that, then there's nothing intrinsically worse about that other than it takes up a little bit more space. But if you're used to this, when you start to look at this, you're not going to see it as clear as easily. So this is why there are coding standards. And if two different people work on the same file, which quite often will happen, and they have different coding standards, then you don't just get this when you look at somebody else's, but you get this in a single class. You might get mixed styles in one file. And it's pretty much inevitable that would happen in a big team if you didn't have standards. So many of the projects that you've looked at, that you're working with for your coursework, the larger ones and the ones that have been around longer will have code standards that you've probably already seen on their website. They'll tell you what sort of indentation and where they want the curly braces and so on. You should use meaningful names for variables and methods. So, you know, don't use x unless it's maybe a coordinate, in which case that might be sensible. You know, give things real names. You should avoid cryptic comments. So don't be clever about commenting. Don't be ironic. You know, don't try and be funny because you can't be sure the person who's reading it is going to have a sense of humor. They may think you actually mean it. And if you write good code, then you shouldn't actually have to put in too many comments, because it should be clear, in many cases it will be clear from the code what you're doing. And this is where experience comes in. Well, both with comments, but this next item, structural complexity. So one of the general rules of, you know, good coding is to not write the same code twice. That's something you probably are all fairly familiar with as a concept. And why, does anyone want to tell me why that's a bad idea to have written the same code twice, other than, you know, you had to type a bit more? Right, exactly. So if you make a change in one copy, then there isn't a systematic way, there's no automated way to notify you, you need to change the other copy as well. So generally speaking, it's a general principle with systems that duplication, some kinds of duplication are not to be desired. So for example, in databases, it's a bad idea to have the same bit of data twice in the database, because then you have to go and update it twice. But you don't want to, when you're coding, you know, you want the code to be fairly easy to read. So you don't want to kind of adhere to this rule about not duplicating things too much, because you quite often find that you can trade off duplication for kind of complexity of the code. And making it more complex just so that you have to avoid writing something twice is not a good idea. So that's a balance that you just have to sort of learn with time. And when in your coding, you want to code cleverly, you want to code sensibly, efficiently, so that you're using the right sort of classes in the right sort of ways. But remember that the next person who's looking at the code might not be as smart as you are. And if you've done something particularly clever, then they may just not get it. And an example of this is recursion. So you've all done functional programming, so you know about recursion, and you know how great recursion can be. People who don't know functional programming are less likely to have come across recursion, and it probably won't be quite as clear to them what's going on. And they'll tend to use iteration instead. So in many coding situations, you've got a choice. You can either have a loop with loop control variables, or you can have a you can implement with recursion. And while recursion is neater and has many advantages, it turns out that it's not something that comes to people naturally. And especially if you didn't start with functional programming, especially if you started with imperative programming. So recursion is something to use in moderation. That's just an example. Right. Yeah, and there's a kind of refactoring thing that you do as you go along, which is get rid of code that isn't doing anything that you know is not used. Unneeded methods, unneeded packaging clues is a really good one. Those things that just kind of tend to the head of the file tends to get more and more includes because no one takes away the ones that aren't needed. So these are all good heuristics. So let's do another little clicker thing. So we've got two different sections of code here, very similar, and the question is which one of these is better, or are they both just as good as each other? So let me see if I can. All right, we'll go down to 15 here. BCA. Ah, okay, so that's 1, 2, and 3. Okay, so people like number 2 here by quite a large margin. Okay, does somebody who voted for number 2 want to say why that's the best?
Because there is one line.
Because there's what?
It's like a line. The indentation is correct. The other one is quite stupid. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
It's the indentation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you'd like to organize it a different way. Well, yeah, so this is just about indentation. So this this indentation makes you think possibly that the loop just applies to this particular line when of course it applies to the whole code section. So indent the lesson here is to indent, consistently. Okay, get rid of that. Okay, and which of these two fragments is better? I think we won't do a clicker question on this. I'll just ask you. Anybody think number 1's better? Number 2? Number 3? Right, we all know why. Why?
It's meaningful.
So what?
Meaningful
variable names, yeah, exactly. So C could be anything. Customer, we know what it's about. Okay, so Now, this one's a bit more interesting. What's wrong with this? I'll let you look at it for a few minutes. Yeah?
The thing that stands out is the inconsistent spacing around the brackets and functions.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So there's no space here. There's spacing between the here, but there's no spacing around the brackets. But here we have spacing. So again, be consistent. And it's amazing how much that affects readability. And use comments, you know, when they're useful, but don't use comments when they're not. So this is an example of a useful comment. So, you know, if the map, the move shape map is null, then we need to find the current position. And we know that all the shapes have the same position. So, you know, when someone's reading this code, they'll read through it and they'll say, okay, this is what I'm trying to do, and this is what I know coming in here. So that's useful. Whereas this is an example of, you know, completely useless commenting. You know, it's a comment, but it doesn't tell you anything, right? Of course, there are variants on this, like, you know, something that's not quite as trivial as this, but it's still a useless comment is, you know, if we don't have a shape map, a move shape map, then, you know, it's just as useless. So, and in fact, too many comments is more of an error than too few. It's more common for people to put in too many comments. And good code shouldn't, as I said before, shouldn't need many explanatory comments. Okay. So there's another use for comments, which is JavaDoc. You've probably all or most of you seen JavaDoc in the projects that you've picked. How many of you have actually written any JavaDoc? Just a few. Okay. So JavaDoc's it's a tool from Sun. It's become a standard with the Java language. And the way it works is that you provide particular kinds of comments along with your methods and your attributes in the classes. And then this JavaDoc system produces nicely formatted and hyperlinked documentation from that. And you can see examples of it. So for example, the API, the Java API at Sun, tells you about all the different classes that are available in the Java libraries, that's all from JavaDoc. And there's a required reading tutorial on this on the web pages. So this is an example of JavaDoc. So it starts with this kind of beginning and ends like this. And here this says there's going to be a paragraph mark. And this says there's a parameter to this method. Its name is URL, and this is a description of what it does. Another parameter, name. This is a description of what it does. There's a return value, and this is the sort of thing that's in the return value. And this is a link to, so C image, in other words, the image class, because it's returning an image. So that's what this sort of structured comment looks like. And the JavaDoc system just goes through and reads this and turns that into nice images or into well-formatted web pages. So for example, in Eclipse, if you click on if you would click on this, then you'll get this little window pop up, and that's the JavaDoc nicely formatted. So this is an incredibly useful thing because it basically means that Eclipse can give you the support. You just hover over or you click on this and you get this description of what this method does. So it means that tools like Eclipse can provide a lot more the support than otherwise. So JavaDoc is something you need to both understand it and be able to create it. When you write code for your coursework, you should use JavaDoc. And the normal thing is that you only document the public methods with JavaDoc because they're the only things that are accessible to anybody else. You can document the private methods if you need to with ordinary comments. Okay, so object orientation is important part of what we're doing, because we're doing everything in Java, but the way that you construct a software system depends on the design. So the kind of breakdown that you get with UML diagrams and so on naturally lends itself to being implemented in an object-oriented way because it looks very object-oriented as a design formalism. So it's a very natural way to do things, but there can be other reasons for implementing in other sorts of languages. So it's not necessarily the case that you're going to do things in an object-oriented language. But whatever kind of language you use, you'll end up using interfaces between components. And Java provides interfaces, which I've been through a little bit, and we'll just look at another example. But you need to understand interfaces and inheritance and classes if you've got any, if you don't feel like you understand all of that kind of really, really quite well, then you should go and review it because you will need it for your coursework. So this is a very common pattern in Java, and we saw an example earlier. So in an earlier lecture. So we define an interface foo, which is going to have some methods in it, some abstract methods, and then we define a class foo-impl, so foo implementation that implements this interface foo. So it's going to have actual implementations of the methods, not just definitions, but implementations. So that's a bit more complicated. We could just say class foo-impl and put the methods in there and forget the interface. So why do you think this is a good thing to do, and why is it so widely used? Well, if all you're doing is this, then, you know, really it's a question of, do you put the method definitions up here, or do you put them down here? So it's not, if all you're doing there is this, sorry? Not really. Yeah, you could. Now, what circumstances might you want to implement it in a different way? Right. Okay, so if you've got an interface that's part of a download system, then it might need to use FTP or HTTP or whatever. Yeah, exactly. So more generally, unless you're absolutely sure that you're never going to want to, no other class you're ever going to write is going to need to use this set of methods, then you might as well have it as an interface, because then you can, then if you want to create subclass, another class, not foo, but something else, that provides the same sort of functionality, then you've already got a specification of that functionality. So it's generally it's a good thing to do to separate these two things out on the basis that it's quite likely that at some point in the future you or somebody else working on the system is going to want to use that functionality in a different class. And if this interface is already defined and documented and so on, they can just say, implements that, everybody knows exactly what that means. So it's a good thing to do, especially in large systems. So here's an example of how it's used in some of the Java libraries. So the way you use this with Java libraries. So there's an interface called I forget what it's called, and it's gone off the screen here. But there's an interface that's provided by the Java libraries that allows you to catch window events. So if you want to create a little component that catches window events, then all you have to do is say, my class is going to implement this interface. And then all you have to do is provide the methods that that interface requires. And then you can fully interoperate with the windowing system. And of course, there are millions and millions of different software components that want to operate with windowing systems. So it absolutely makes sense to have this as an interface. Another example that you'll see if you look at GUI code, Swing GUI code, is this sort of thing. So this says, give me a button. So this is a class that's provided by the library. And I'm going to add an action listener. Now, this is an interface action listener. So this is it, when you see this, first see this, you kind of think, this is weird. I'm doing new on an interface. I thought I could only do new on classes. Well, it turns out you can do new on an interface when it has just a single method like this, or in fact multiple methods. If you define all the methods, then you're creating what's called an inner class here, and this implements the method required by the action listener interface. So this is a very common pattern that you'll see in lots and lots of interface code. You'll see in lots of graphical user interface code using this Java interface. There are a few too many interfaces in all this. Okay, so that's interfaces. You need to be very familiar with interfaces and understand them. And you'll find in the package, a lot of the packages that you've picked, a lot of the ones that I've looked at have interfaces all over the place. So you need to be familiar with them. Now, you know Java has packages. So how do you decide what to put in a package? So packages are units of encapsulation. They're bigger than classes, but smaller than the whole system, typically. So in a package, attributes and methods are visible between the different classes. So if a class is in the same package as another class, it can see the public methods within the of classes in the same package and the non-public ones. It also gives a way to organize the namespace, so it means that you can have classes with the same name in different packages, and they won't conflict. And that's good because that means that, because typically, you know, one team will be implementing one package and another team another package. They might not even be working in the same organization. And you can still use their classes even if they've given their classes the same name as some of yours, because they're in a different package, and that qualifies the name. And it also allows related pieces of code to be grouped together. So that's sort of the essence of an encapsulation, is putting things together that belong together. So they're most useful when there are several people working on projects or multiple groups of multiple teams. But one of the things that you have to remember is that the package hierarchy is not like the Java hierarchy. And that can be it's sometimes easy to forget this. But with the Java hierarchy, there's a relationship. The hierarchy means something. So there's inheritance within the Java class hierarchy. The package hierarchy is just like a file system. It doesn't have any meaning. Except as in the file system, it provides a namespace. So if you have, a parent package and a sub package, then the namespace will be parent.child.class. So it only the hierarchy is only meaningful in the namespace arena. So. This is an example that I think you'll appreciate when we've been through it. Shows how kind of confusing packages and inheritance and so on can be, and how you have to really try and keep these things straight. So let's say you've got a class eduni.inf.jcb.myong inherits from a class eduni.inf.cardgame. And it inherits a protected method deal. So what does protected mean? Sorry? Yeah, exactly. It reflects inheritance, so subclasses can access it. Oops, where are we? Okay. So this method deal is protected. That means it can only be accessed by the class and subclasses. So somewhere in the Mahjong class, there's the following code. So we're going to create a card game. We're going to declare a variable that's of type card game, C, and we're going to assign a new card game to it. Okay, so this is a card game. C is a card game. Card game inherits from Mahjong. It inherits this protected method deal. So the question is this going to compile? So why don't you just kind of talk to a few people nearby you for just a couple of minutes about this, whether this is going to compile or not, and then we'll go through it. Okay, let's leave it at that. I'm sure some of you have figured this out, and some of you are probably still arguing about it. So here are some options that you could choose. So yes, it would even if we removed protected. So if the field isn't protected anymore, but it wouldn't if we removed protected. No. Deal needs to be public because card game and Mahjong are in different packages. And no, we wouldn't unless we made some other change. So let's do some quick voting on this. If I can start this here. I'll give you a bit longer to make your minds up on this one. Okay, so 5 people think A, 3 people think B,
6 people think C and 4 people think D.
Okay, well, let's have a look and see what the right answer is. Okay, the right answer was C, it does not compile. So the reason for that is that, do we have still have the code somewhere? Here we go. So as it says here, the reference through which the protected method is accessed has to be of the same class or a subclass as the class where the reference is made. Okay? So that's a bit confusing, but basically the reference through which the protected method is accessed, so that's this is where the protected method is accessed, and it's accessed through C. And C is not a subclass of the class where this is being at, where it's being accessed. So it's being accessed from this class Mahjong, which is not a subclass of C, of the class that C is of. So C is a card game. So that it's the parent of Mahjong. So this is going to fail. So one way to solve that would be to make the method public. Or another way, there are several other ways. So for example, if we, let me go to here. So this, this is different. Okay, you'll see this is it's basically exactly the same, except the access method here, we're accessing it from this. So this refers, of course, to the class Mahjong, and so that is allowed. So that will compile. It doesn't need to be super. This can access this protected method because Mahjong is a subclass.
Yeah, it inherits it. But my idea is, if we need the original deal.
Oh, if yeah.
The new deal is overloaded, not overloaded.
There may be other ways that you can do it.
Fine deal in Mahjong and you need the card game deal, can you call it super?
So here you say, well you could say super dot deal, but it doesn't, this is actually doing something else.
No, I'm not referring to this one.
Oh.
So if you still want to call card game deal somewhere else in Mahjong, can you call it with super deal?
Yeah, you should be able to, I think, if I understand you correctly. So that works if you change C so it's not a card game anymore, but it's of class Mahjong, then that's going to work because it's similar to using this. And if you get rid of the packages, it's going to work because they're no longer in separate packages. So it will be able to see card game. So you know, these are all very slightly different variations, and three of them compile and one of them doesn't. So you'll find when you start writing code with packages and inheritance that you get into this sort of situation where something doesn't compile and you can't figure out why it is. And quite often the solution is to go back and look very carefully at the rules about access. Okay. Let's see, we're at 6 o'clock, so I think I'll probably stop here, and there's just a few more slides, but we'll do them at the beginning of the next lecture. Right.
Because he had a target file to download needed plugins, but that target file pointed to a local directory without giving me any indication of what plugins he needed. So I went through the error list and manually found and pulled the plugins.
So you had to change the...
So I had to change the target class and extend it by like 8 entries. And find that, yeah, that took a while, especially if you've never touched any of this before.
Yeah, that's a good learning experience.
You're rather confused. Anyway, yeah, no, he uses in his
So this is using Maven, is it?
No, this is using Eclipse, downloading a CVS. I use Tortoise CVS first, but can't do that because when you do that and then you import it into Eclipse for his build, it doesn't work.
So you can use it from inside Eclipse, yeah. Eclipse.
Right, but I looked at his user documentation and tried to use that, but the version of Eclipse he's using doesn't exist anymore. It was discontinued.
Oh.
Eclipse for RCP and plugin developers, and that doesn't exist anymore. There's only it used to exist, but not anymore. There's only for ARP developers now, and that meant I had more plugins than I didn't have compared to him. And I'm probably going to write some proper documentation for all three systems.
Right. Okay.
As to translation, mm-hmm. he's explicitly asking if anyone can translate it for him into different languages.
Well, yeah, I mean, translation is not something that is... translation on its own isn't something that you know, would really qualify. And I think the guidance says that. But if you're writing, you know, if you're writing documentation and you want to write it in, you know, multiple languages, then
there's probably no point to writing it in multiple languages if the actual program isn't available in multiple languages.
Yeah.
Either I do the full Monty and translate everything. Good thing is you can get the databases in different languages. You just can't get.
When you say translate it, do you mean translate the program so that it's so internationalized?
Yeah.
Oh, that's different. Because that's coding. I thought you meant translate the documentation.
Oh, no. There isn't any documentation.
Right.
There's only a couple, there's only like 2 developers working on it.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's fine. If you want to internationalize
it, translate the I was going to translate the program itself. So everything in the user interface is separate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's called internationalization.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things that he's asked people to do explicitly.
Because there are libraries, I think, that will help with that sort of thing, aren't there? Or is it?
I don't know. I haven't looked yet.
I think there are. Certain amount of it is custom, has to be custom for the program. But I think there are libraries that will help with that. Because there are such standard GUI components, you know, like OK and submit and open and close and yes and no, and all those sorts of things, which are, if there's some sort of program specific.
Very program specific. Well, it's not program specific, it's a certain user base, certain knowledge that talks right. about it.
And how are you going to, so you'll change the build so somehow it knows what, it's some configuration parameter or something?
I'm probably going to, since he does all the, he makes all the changes himself, I'm going to make a full version that's translated completely, upload it, and ask him to put out a separate build for it.
Right. Because it's probably something that he would want to just have as a configuration parameter.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I'd implement that though yet.
Well, maybe not. It might be something that happens at build time. So it might be a, you know, build time it gets English files or it gets Hungarian files or whatever it is.
Well, I'd only translate it into German.
German, right, yeah.
And I don't know enough French to translate it into French.
Yeah. Well, typically the way GUI interface components, the text and interface components gets in is through a resources file. So there's things called resource bundles. Mm. And typically you get all the text in through a resource bundle. So that if you do it that way, you should look at resource bundles. But if you do it that way, then what you basically do is provide a file with all the bits of text mapped to sort of tag name or variable name or something. Mm. And then when it gets built, it just pulls that out of whichever file.
Yeah, and then you can probably give some kind of probable option during build time.
Yeah, so it